Lily.
I'm Lex.
And we're the dry Claire. We're the crime drama queens.
we're the dry karma. We're all about dishing up that dry karma.
Okay. We are going to be very serious today. Because we're talking about a very serious programme, aren't we, Lex?
Very serious programme. I mean, serious crime against...
Yes, a crime against drama.
Against broadcasting.
Before we kick off, we wanted to just quickly say, because we always forget to mention this because we're too busy talking about people's hair or who Drew fancies at any given time. So we keep forgetting to say, please do follow us on socials if you so wish. We put it on Facebook and Instagram. We say what we're going to be covering the following week, so everyone has a chance to watch it if they wish. So if you want to know what we're going to be watching and talking about, then you should probably get on board with our socials. So Instagram and Facebook, just at Crime Drama Queens. And you can always email us at crimedramaqueens@gmail.com. And yes, please do rate and review us. It really does help us lots and lots. And we're ever so grateful. So thank you so, 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 so much. And thank you for the lovely, lovely ratings and reviews that we've had so far. We do really appreciate it.
We do indeed.
So today, and Lex is really looking forward to this, some of the messages I've had, I can only describe as just incandescent rage as Lex has been watching this. Just the fury about every aspect of it has been, that word?
I think it's, like I said to you, visceral I've watched it three times. It is a visceral hatred. I watched it three times because I got really poor memory, as I said to you, which would be fine if it was a 45-minute episode. And that's what I would argue it was worth, right?
Yeah, I think maybe an hour, 75 minutes tops, they could have fitted it all in.
It was essentially 3 hours. So I have invested, let me just make sure, 9 hours of my life... 9 hours,
and that's really for this podcast. Just think, you wouldn't have had to do that. So this is Lex laying her sanity on the line.
Yep,
and we're all very grateful.
Now
I didn't hate it as much as Lex did, but it did make me feel a little bit weary.
Just
this week we watched the Marlowe Murder Club season 1 episodes 1 and 2. It was first broadcast on Wednesday, March the 6th and Thursday, March 7th, 2024 on the Drama Channel. We watched it on ITV Play or something like that. What was it called? UK TV Play.
UK TV, yeah.
We watched it on the UK TV Play app.
Yeah.
Which is fine. It had ads. It did have ads. But, you know, whatever. It was free. Cool. It was written by Robert Thorogood and directed by Steve Barron. Now, if you've heard of the name of Robert Thorogood, it may be because he created and wrote Death in Paradise, or at least, you know, the first season of Death in Paradise or something before they started to get armies of writers in to do it. And I read an interview with him in the Radio Times. So I just thought I'd mention it now because I thought it was quite an interesting insight into why he wrote this. So after he did Death in Paradise, which was his sort of take on Poirot, the idea of this very clever, fastidious detective joining a team where he's the fish out of water. Now, of course, Poirot is the foreigner and people don't always take him seriously as a result, whereas arguably the guy from the Met, whichever guy it is from the Met at any given time, so if we say it was the Ben Miller character, that he is the boss, he's the clever white man. So I'm not quite sure that it's exactly the same as Poirot. I wouldn't put them side by side, but I see what he was trying to do by having that kind of the fish out of water approach. And he said that the Marlowe Murder Club was his take on Miss Marple. Now there's two... Sorry, I'm just gonna geek out just for just 2 minutes, just bear with
me. I'm enjoying it very much.
Thank you, you're very, very tolerant. So with Miss Marple, there are two major facets to the Miss Marple character and how she works as a detective. Now, the first part is that she is a little old lady. And I think this is what he's talking about here. This is what Robert Thorogood means here, is that he has got some women who are usually dismissed as just being, you know, a bit old, or you're just a wife, or you're just a mother, or you're just this, you're just that, and are overlooked. in the same way that Miss Marple is overlooked as, you know, a poor detective. So I appreciate what he's trying to do. He's empowering women, and he's trying to empower the older woman or the woman who's a little bit downtrodden and overshadowed by her husband or her family life. And I appreciate that. And I will always appreciate any program that has lots and lots of roles for women, especially older women. That's fantastic. But the other thing that's quite key about Miss Marple, and it's fine, I get it. He's just being inspired by Miss Marple. He doesn't have to like cover all of it and make it, you know, just like that. But the other quite important thing about Miss Marple is that people, she's a little old woman who people overlook, and that's how she does her detection, because no one notices that she's there. She's just this twittering old lady, just gently asking questions and overhearing things and eavesdropping, watching from her garden or whatever, and no one pays her any attention. So no one even really realises that she's on the case.
In comparison,
Mrs. Potts and her crew they are just
tenacious.
I would say just nuisances. Nuisances who should be just like formally warned by the police to stay away.
I mean, we'll get into this, but arguably they are. On many occasions for the first hour and 26 minutes told to, quite frankly, fuck off.
Yes, and also, quite rightly.
And yet they see it as a challenge. They're like, we're not going to stop investigating, are we?
The amount of times they really endangered the investigation. They do themselves? Illegal stuff. Yeah, they endangered themselves. If you think back to all the stuff that they do and all the illegal bits and bobs, the whole case would probably be like thrown out on technicalities by the time by the time they actually, you know, defense lawyers get to it.
Like breaking and entering, breaching police security. Files. And they're like, oh, has anyone seen the files? And then they cut to the three of them sat around with like tea and biscuits or something going, should we really have these? And she's like, well, what am I like?
No, you shouldn't.
It's confidential.
This is, you've taken it off. Oh, for goodness sake. It's completely bonkers. So yes, I appreciate that he's going for the overlooked older woman aspect of Miss Marple, but I would say that the main thing about Miss Marple is how she hides in plain sight. These guys are not hiding in plain sight. They are just...
Like, you know, like when your child comes back from nursery with a biscuit that you know has been sneezed over and it's got loads of like different coloured icing and sprinkles. Like, you appreciate the thought, but the execution's quite important.
Yes, yes, yes.
I'm not going to touch the biscuit.
I think that's a very good analogy. Don't touch.
Touch the sneeze biscuit.
What you do is you take the biscuit, you wrap it in a paper towel, and you say, let's save this one for Daddy. And I want a kid to... But you don't have to give it to Daddy. I'm not trying to poison Daddy here. But yeah, you dispose of that toxic biscuit. But yes, we appreciate the thought. So Robert Thorogood also, the thing I thought was quite interesting, is actually this is a series of books, which Lex will, I suspect, not be reading. But after Death in Paradise came out, it was a huge success. This was the idea that Robert Thorogood had next, and the BBC, for whatever reason, wouldn't commission it. So he went off and he wrote a series of books, and then finally they have been adapted, I think, by him into this. So it's taken a while for it to arrive on our screens. And I find it frustrating because I think there are plenty of really good ideas, but like you were talking about the biscuit, I think a lot of it is in the execution. Anyway, we'll just have a little look at what Wikipedia has to say. So, and I quite enjoyed this one. So Wikipedia says, former archaeologist Judith Potts goes for a swim and hears a gunshot at the home of her neighbour Stephen Dunwoody's house. Judith teams up with the vicar's wife and a local dog walker to investigate. Now, all of that is true, but I feel like...
It's missing quite a lot.
It's missing some key components. So, Lex, do you want to tell us about the main detectives, such as they are?
So you've got Judith Potts, who is Samantha Bond, who I should say... I think is great. Under normal circumstances, I love Samantha Bond.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of Annika when we said...
Nicola Walker's never done anything bad in her career.
Until now, we've never disliked her in anything.
So this, yes, Judith Potts, she's a retired archaeologist living in a fucking massive multi-million pound house on the banks of the Thames in Marlow. And she's the driving horse driving.
She may as well be driving a horse.
she's driving a horse behind this amateur investigation. Are we going to overlook the swimming in the... Yeah,
I think we will get to the swimming.
We'll get to that.
That's a whole other thing, isn't it?
So we've got Judith Potts. We've also got Bec Starling. She is the vicar's wife. She's underappreciated, and she's a mother of apparently two teenagers. I really have to argue about the age of one of them because she definitely isn't the age that she's playing. But anyway,
it's weird,
we'll get onto
it?
That. Really weird. And at one point, we find her hiding in a cupboard in the church for a bit of peace and quiet. And I can identify with that. I get it.
Yeah, I totally would do that. Yeah, and she's like having a cup of tea and she's watching something on a tablet or something.
Yeah.
I would have the headphones on just to make sure that no one could hear, and I would definitely be safe in my little cubby hole.
Yeah, that's where she... I think that was the fault in her plan, lack of headphones.
Yeah.
So we've got her, and then we've got Susie Harris, who is a local dog walker and a single mum whose daughter is off exploring the world, leaving her alone for the first time. And she was friends with a guy called Iqbal, who was the second victim, and she looked after his dog for him. And for whatever reason, the three of them come together to investigate the crime. And if that seems implausible, just wait. And we also have... DS Tanika Malik, she's the SIO on the case, and is in turn frustrated and grateful by the interference of the other three. She's got a team of detectives behind her, but this is the first case that she's in charge of. And it shows.
Yeah, it shows. It shows. And it's frustrating because she's got this fairly like anonymous team, but then she's got this one colleague called Brendan, who's supposed to be, I mean, he is, he undermines her a lot. Often he is, unfortunately, saying very sensible stuff when he's like, you can't be listening to Mrs. Potts and her friends, which is quite right.
Fair.
It's fair. Very fair. But Tanika's like, no, I think it's going to be okay.
It's just weird. Anyway, the crime.
The crime. There are three murders. The first is the shooting of Stephen Dunwoodie at his house in Marlow. His neighbour, Judith Potts, the aforementioned Judith Potts, is out swimming. She's swimming naked, to be precise, in the Thames. We don't know why she's swimming naked in the Thames. No one seems to care that she's swimming naked in the Thames.
And it's like, within the first 3 minutes, I can't remember if that's before the credits or just after, but anyway, it's very early on. And suddenly we're like, oh, Samantha Bond. Oh, God, it's a naked Samantha Bond.
Swimming.
And she's having the time of her life.
This is one of the things that really annoys me as well. I found the characters quite inconsistent, especially the character of Judith, because she's very uptight about some things and she flies off the handle. But then also she's really like caring and impulsive and intuitive. But she swims naked and people, I mean, it's the Thames. It's not some kind of like deserted little plunge pool, you know, hidden away on the moors. She's swimming on the Thames in Marlow. It's quite busy.
It's full of E. coli.
And everyone's like, hi, Mrs. Potts. And she's like, hi. And she's fine. It's hot. Maybe she doesn't want a wetsuit, but there's no explanation or reference to the fact that she is naked.
No.
I don't understand any of it. I just don't understand any of it. Anyway, fine. So she's naked. She's naked in quite a busy Thames. So she's out swimming. At the time, she hears the shot. She calls the police, but they don't take her seriously because, she pesters them and then winds up breaking into Stephen's house and finding his body herself. He was shot. And we find out the medallion was left at the crime scene, but we don't find that out till a bit later on. But the second victim, Iqbal Kassam, was shot in his bed and a medallion left with him. And the third victim, Liz Curtis, was shot on the banks of the River Thames and, of course, left with a medallion. So, Lex, do you want to run us through the suspects?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few suspects. So we've got, for the murder of Stephen Dunwoodie, we've got Elliot Howard, or his wife, Daisy.
She's a very miserable woman.
She's so miserable. I don't, genuinely, she does not crack a smile at all for the 3 hours that this went on. But Stephen and Elliot had a very public falling out. For the murder of Iqbal Kassam, we've got Giles Bishop, who Iqbal knew was forging wills in his own favour.
Dodgy bastard.
Lovely. And then for the murder of Liz Curtis, there's no one obvious, but her husband does inherit. So
there's that.
The thing is, not only do all the suspects all have alibis, but each victim was shot with the same gun and they were all left with a Freemason's medallion. So it appears they were all killed by the same person. What connects them?
Such a good question.
Such a good question. One of many questions.
So the investigation. Now, I've tried to condense this down, but, you know, just bear with. So Judith Potts, naked Samantha Bond. She's very pushy from the off. So she's out skinny dipping, like we said, when she hears a gunshot coming from Stephen Dunwoody's house. And she and we assume that Stephen Dunwoody is dead, or like shot, at least, in trouble. She tells the police and they don't take it seriously. We meet DS Tanika Malik, who is temporarily in charge while Inspector whatever anonymous person who we don't care about is ill. Yeah, like we said, she's got a fairly typical team with a misogynistic colleague to beat.
Lovely.
Judith breaks into Stefan's house, finds his body floating in the water just outside by... It's not like the actual river, is it? It's like a little substitute that comes to his garden or something. Yeah. I don't really know. While waiting for the police, she also finds a bullet casing, which she has a good look at, she measures, and it has a little Nazi symbol on it. Tanika and the police tell her to go home and leave them to the investigation. But Judith doesn't want to do that. So she decides to investigate herself. She goes to his gallery where he works and she speaks to his assistant about anyone who might have had a grudge. And the assistant says that Elliot Howard, who's like he runs the local auction house along with his wife Daisy, Elliot had a big shouting match with Stefan at the local regatta. And if you don't know what a regatta is, it's basically men in red trousers and like stripy jackets and boaters watching drinking some pims. Rowing and drinking pims while women called Octavia and Prudence have large hats and also sip pims.
Yes.
It's my understanding. So, yeah, he runs a local auction house. He had a big fight with Stefan at the local regatta. So off Judith goes to go and see Elliot. He is very rude to her. And also, he has a stone-cold alibi. He was at choir practice that night. Judith wants to corroborate this, so she goes to the church looking for proof. And that's when she finds the vicar's wife, Bex, hiding in a cupboard. Bex, who, despite having just moved to the area, knows everyone... She says, yeah, actually, I was at choir practice too, and Elliot was definitely there. And then Judith asks her questions about Elliot and Stefan, but she says, actually, because she's new to the area, she doesn't really know that much. So Judith suggests that perhaps Bex could use her position as a vicar's wife to have a nose around and find out some things. Because again,
she's not even being subtle.
No. And then there's this weird bit where Bex is like, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. And then suddenly... Judith climbs up onto the pulpit and just starts like quoting the Bible at her.
And then she's like, oh, quoting the Bible at me, that's a low blow or something. I'm like, not really. A, it's just words. But also, whatever Judith is wearing does kind of look, it's kind of emblematic of a priest's robe. I don't know if it's meant to be symbolism. It's quite lazy. It's quite badly executed. It's just shit. Also, in choir practice, they never ever, at any point during the programme, sing actual words. They just sing the word la, la, la over and over again, also quite badly, quite discordantly. And at one point, the vicar's wife says, we're not allowed to leave choir practice, like it's some kind of hostage situation going on.
Yeah, I noticed like, that.
We're not allowed to leave.
Someone's having a heart attack. Don't call an ambulance. They can't leave.
The alto line needs you.
Don't join the church choir, guys. It seems quite intense.
Anyway.
All right. So Bex is a bored, put upon housewife and mother. And husband and kids take her for granted and don't notice her anymore. And at one point that is shown by her accidentally smashing her best mum mug.
Yeah. Also, her daughter is meant to be 17.
And looks 12.
And definitely 12 max. When she's like, I'm going to the pub, I'm like, you absolutely are.
You're not.
And if you go, good luck, because you're not getting served. Child's menu, yeah. Maybe. But anyway.
Yes. All right. So she starts thinking about helping Judith. And that night, while Judith is in her massive mansion all alone, a brick is hurtled through the window and it has a note on it saying, stay away. But whose handwriting is it? Who is this note from? Probably
from the props department at the Good Ship Murder. Stay away.
Stay away.
Blunt force trauma. Anyway.
Bex decides to help Judith investigate, so she invites the village know-it-all, Mrs. Eddingham, round for tea and sandwiches and tells her that her husband, as the vicar, will be doing Stefan's eulogy, and since they are new in town, he needs to know all about Stefan's life. So Mrs. Eddingham is a massive gossip and gets stuck in. So we hear bits and bobs about Stefan and how he was a nice chap, but also a massive con artist. We'll get into that later on. So around this time, we also meet Susie. So she's a dog walker, and she's friends with a very nice chap called Iqbal. He's a taxi driver, and she walks his dog for him when he's working. Susie's daughter has just been travelling, and Susie's really looking forward to having her home. But her daughter has just called to say, actually, she's not coming home yet. She's enjoying herself too much. Susie, like Bex, is feeling a bit down and wondering what her life has become beyond being a mum, yada yada. She goes round to Iqbal's house to, like, pick up the dog. And there's no answer, but the door is unlocked. She goes in, and he's been shot through the head in his bed, and a medallion has been left in his mouth. Murder number two. Judith, for some reason, she's with Tanika, and they get the call saying there's being another murder. Tanika's just trying to get rid of her at this point. Just go away, Mrs. Potts. But the police head to Iqbal's after telling Judith to go away again. She obviously doesn't go away. We see her, like, cycling past the crime scene, trying to look inconspicuous. And it's just as the police are talking to Susie. Susie offered to take Iqbal's dog, Luna, which she helpfully tells us used to belong to Iqbal's neighbour, Ezra. Remember Ezra? Mm. He comes back. Well, not actually. He's dead, right? So he's not going to come back, but he'll come back into the story. So Judith takes Susie and Luna home, and Judith tells her where to find her if she wants to talk any further about maybe investigating Iqbal's murder. Susie thinks about it and does, and she shows up at Judith's house just as Bex does, and they decide to investigate the murders together. They look at Judith's murder board. Yay! She has a murder board, and she has all, like, the bits of string.
String.
Yeah, pinned up, like, pins. Connecting things and articles from newspapers and pictures. That, how do you get pictures of suspects like that? I understand if you're the police and you're like, we just get a little mugshot just so we can put you on our murder board. But how, as Judith, how she got, like, a picture of Elliot Howard and his wife and stuff?
I also don't know if we're going to get to this, but there's a... I don't know if this is meant to be about her fastidious kind of organised nature, but she often is creating crosswords.
Oh, she's a crossword setter. Did they say that she's a crossword setter at some point?
I don't know. But it doesn't seem to add any. But, yeah, like, she's organised with her murder board. She likes
solving puzzles? Is that where we're supposed to do with that?
I don't know. But they keep peppering it in throughout the thing amongst murder boards and stuff. Like, look, she's organised creating a crossword. Now look at her murder board, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
But I don't really see the point in it.
Maybe she's really good at anagrams. Maybe she would have solved the whole, like, Harold Manners thing before Morse.
No one ever sat around, like, reading a Where's Wally book. There he is.
I like puzzles. Right, yes. So Bex tells them what she got from Mrs. Eddingham. Stefan was a con artist. He ran a scam with Elliot's dad, massively undervaluing art, buying it and then selling it on at huge profits, or just sometimes keeping the artwork for himself. So they decide they need to find out if Elliot's handwriting matches the stay away note, which I just love the idea that people just write these things in their handwriting.
In their own handwriting.
Let's just do that. No one will ever suss it out. They decide that Bex and Susie, as he doesn't know who they are, will go to his auction house and try and get a sample of his handwriting. They will be connected to Judith via a WhatsApp video call. I think it was that, wasn't it? Was it WhatsApp? And there's a bit where Judith like accidentally puts like a doggy face over her own, and it was supposed to be lols, I think. Mega lols. Right, so while they're there, the police show up to ask Elliot about a Nazi gun that he sold to someone. So they prick up their ears and they're like, ooh, Nazi gun. That must be the gun that was used in the murders. So Susie causes a distraction by like knocking something over and going, oh, no.
Like a bucket or something. She's like, oh, you shouldn't leave those lying around.
And so then for some reason, Elliot and all the police run over to see if she's okay. While Bex has a look at the little receipt from, the, you know, whoever bought the gun. So she takes a photo so we can find out who now owns the Nazi gun. Right. So it turns out it's a chap called Chris Bott, who, believe it or not, also sings in the church choir. So he couldn't have.
What are the chances?
Nevertheless, Judith, Bex and Susie go and pay him a visit. As Judith is a retired archaeologist, she talks to him about the importance of artefacts and how a civilization's weaponry can tell you so much about them. He heartily agrees, and then he shows them his massive, terrifying Nazi shrine, which is basically like some kind of SS office with just, it's like a mannequin dressed up.
It's like a mannequin in like an SS suit.
And they're all like, oh no, he's a nutter.
There is zero notice. Yeah. Zero notice given. Zero. It's literally like 1 minute, come through.
I quite liked it. It was quite funny just how they are as shocked as we are. And then Judith has to bring it round to, so, do you have a gun? And he's like, oh, yeah, I've got a Luger or whatever kind of gun it is. But then he goes to get it so he can show them. But guess what? It's missing. It's been stolen. Just then, armed police, like, burst in to arrest Chris, like, crashing through windows and everything. But of course, then they also realise that the gun isn't there and also that he has an alibi. Hey-ho. So on to Stefan's funeral. During the burial, I think Judith spots a woman watching at a distance. And they're like, ooh, who's that? Who's that? I mean, it could have just been like someone having a walk in the graveyard. It doesn't have to be someone who's relevant.
Could have been the guy filming from Waking the Dead at the rubbish pit.
Yeah, could have been that guy. Yeah, could have been anyone. All right, so looking through the Book of Condolence after the funeral, Judith spots the handwriting from the warning note. It's Daisy Howard, Elliot's miserable wife. They confront her, and she said that she just kind of assumed that Elliot and Judith were having an affair, as he is a total scumbag. And so that's why he was like, she was like, oh, stay away. She also admits that Elliot hated Stefan. Elliot's father had a Stanley Spencer painting, and when he died, he didn't leave it to Elliot, he left it to Stefan. So there's quite a lot of bad blood there. Then I go on about the Stanley Spencer for eight.
Yeah.
That night, someone breaks into Stefan's house. Judith decides to go and investigate.
It's one of my favourite bits.
She's creeping around this house and then she gets knocked out. Deservedly so.
She's like, stop, who goes there? They literally run towards her, smash her around the face with a torch.
Yep.
And she seems surprised.
Yeah, like, unbelievable.
Duh.
She's an absolute liability. So Judith has an idea and she's like, come on. And is this when she breaks into the police station? She breaks into the police station, then they're all talking about her, and then she just joins in. She's like, I've had an idea.
It's a bit. They're in the, like, the...
Tanaka's like, how did you get in? This is literally a police station. Come on, guys. Don't let random people walk in off the streets.
She literally, like, and it's not even misdirection done well, but she kind of does the whole, like, look over there, and then suddenly she slips through a door, but it's really clumsy.
Very clumsy.
And they're in, like, yeah, the investigation room where they're briefing and talking about what's happening, and then they're talking about, like, what a liability Mrs. Potts is, and then she's like, hello!
It's Mrs. Potts... She something about the medallions and how there was a medallion, and so there's probably a medallion with Stefan. So she gets like a metal detector and hovers it over this water, the water where Stefan's body was found. And then, what do you know? She manages to find this medallion.
What are the chances?
And Tanaka's like, wow, she's really good. She knows everything. So then Tanaka hires her, Bex, and Susie as police advisors.
I don't even think that's a thing.
I don't think that's a thing. And, right, so they're not qualified at all. They have no inside information.
They've not had security clearance.
No security. There's nothing. There's nothing. It's not like they're even like private investigators who have loads of experience and are qualified and nothing. Nothing at all. They, Susie's quite involved with the local community, but Bex is new to the area and Judith's quite a recluse, so they don't really have like insider knowledge of the community. All they have is a few wacky ideas, and then they just suggest to the police stuff that the police would just obviously be doing anyway.
You know when you're like a child and you and your friends decide that you're going to have like a secret society and you're like, we're going to have like a logo. Oh my God, we can have like a password. It's it's that, but with women who are old enough to know better.
Yes, it is. It is. And then they do stuff like, they find these medallions and they're like, faith, hope. So isn't that from the Freemasons? And then they turn to Tanaka and they're like, right, we need a list of all Freemasons members in the area. And Tanaka's like, yes, good idea. As if like she wouldn't have thought of that herself.
And if she hasn't, I have questions.
Yes. Yes. About all of them. Yes.
Just many questions.
Right. So the, yes, they found it's faith, hope. And then, of course, there is a third medallion yet to be found, because that will be the charity one. And that implies there'll be a third Manda. Fine. So at Mrs. Potts's instigation, the police get a list of local Freemasons, but none of the suspects are on it. We do find out that Elliot used to be a Freemason, though, which is interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah. Now, Judith has stolen all the police files to take home. I'm pretty sure that is illegal.
And she's just sort of, no one's noticed her going
walking out with this
massive stack of files.
Absolutely. It's not something that would just fit in your handbag.
Don't mind me. See you tomorrow, guys. Yeah, nope.
At the end of the day, they just let her wander out and they're like, I guess you just put the files away.
And then they're like, oh, where have they gone? Oh.
Well, business parts. Right, the files, there's mention of the red-headed woman seen at the funeral. And then Bex, who knows everyone despite only just moving there, she identifies her as Liz Curtis, because they do yoga together.
Of course they do.
Liz runs the local rowing centre with her husband, Danny. She's also a killer, according to Susie. We're like, what? And it turns out she had a perfectly healthy dog put down, which is pretty wrong. It's pretty horrible, but also there's no other, like, that's all you really find out about her. So off they go to see Liz Curtis. She claims she didn't even know whose funeral it was, and she's a bit off with them. Then they have a chat with her husband, Danny. He says she's not been herself since Stefan was killed. And then, they knew each other a bit from, like, art stuff. What?
I mean, she just seems off as a general personality type.
Yes. And there doesn't seem to be why she's so upset at Stefan's death, or why she's so stressed, or why anything.
Why she keeps crying for no apparent reason. It's just weird.
We don't find out, do we? Or did I just forget that? Or just
no, we don't find out. No, right. We don't find out.
She also has used Iqbal's taxi service. So there's a connection there. Liz and Danny met rowing. She, however, went on to win a gold medal at, was it Sydney or Athens or something? But he was never that great. And then while they're chatting, one of the women swipes a notebook to get Liz's fingerprints. Then they go to Iqbal's house because Susie still has a key from looking after the dog. And they have a snoop around there. They check the call log on his phone and they see that there is a call from Liz's mobile. And she did call and book a taxi. Judith opens his post again. Illegal.
Yep.
And finds a letter from a solicitor telling him that although his neighbour Ezra had written a will leaving all his money to him, Iqbal, there was another will made shortly before he died leaving all of his money to his solicitor, Giles Bishop, instead. And I think that's quite a lot of information to share with someone who is just not a beneficiary of a will. Wouldn't you just say, actually, you know, there is that will predates the current will. I'm sorry, you're no longer a beneficiary, and probably just cap the information there. Right?
Yeah, you wouldn't go into detailed minutiae about who is. You can find him here, and his contact number is here.
Suspicious, eh? Right, so they take the women take their findings to the police. So they've got the proof that Liz called Iqbal and used his taxi, and they've got the notebook with her fingerprints. Then they decide that they're off in pursuit of Giles Bishop, the dodgy-sounding solicitor. They follow him using more WhatsApp calls and all this ham-drammery. And then Judith confronts him about the change to Ezra's will and how it seems a bit fishy that Ezra left him all his money. Giles denies everything. So then Judith again sneaks into his offices, where she's like, oh, I have to go and give Mr. Bishop his pen back. And the receptionist's like, yeah, cool. And so she's wandering around these offices. And she witnesses Giles, just at that moment, taking out a piece of paper and shredding it. That must be relevant, surely, to their case. Right, Lex?
I mean, yes. Also, right, the shredding, we'll get to this. Right, but most shredders that I have used shred paper into pieces that are smaller than I could manage to do myself by hand. That is generally the purpose of a shredder.
That's the point.
Yeah. It's generally the point. You can't then, let's just say, piece the stuff back together. I'm just going to leave that
there. It's like a whole
fluff,
like a bird's nest of fluff. It's not, yes, it's not like massive big strips.
It's
however,
not centimeter wide strips. Putting that out there.
So Judith goes back and tells Bex and Susie that he was shredding this thing. So they need to obviously break in and steal the shredded paper so that they can put it back together.
And it, at no point does anyone go, okay, this has gone a bit far now. Like,
are we actually going to be able to do this? Is it possible to put stuff together like that? They're just like, okay, you dress up as this, and I'll dress up as that. And then
Bex has got, I was like, why is she slicing a sourdough loaf?
Yeah.
And then she's putting slices of bread in her pockets. And I was like, I really don't understand what's going on here. And then we've got Mrs. Potts being dressed up like your sort of quintessential old lady with a headscarf and some weird spectacles and in a wheelchair because obviously age equals immobility.
Yes.
And then you've got Susie who still has a dog lead on her because despite not really having a dog on her at most for most of the programme has to be accessorised with a fucking dog lead because otherwise we'd forget she was a dog walker.
She has like a bum bag full of like poo bags and stuff. Again, she's a dog walker.
She's a dog walker. We wouldn't remember that if we didn't have the prop. Oh, it's just, there's like a thing with a fire alarm and a...
Yeah, so Bex goes in. Bex breaks in somehow, doesn't she? I can't even remember because, again, my brain has just disposed of this unnecessary detail. But she's in there. She goes to the kitchen. She burns the toast to set off the fire alarm. Then... I still don't really understand the purpose of Mrs. Potts being in this wheelchair, but then Susie climbs on top of her and breaks in through a window to drill and steal the shred. Why don't they just wait for the bags of the shredded paper to be put out for pickup?
Also, the fact that they then exchange it for shredded paper in the bottom of, like, somebody's hamster cage or gerbil cage. And I'm like, I'm not sure I'd be checking the contents of my shredder that closely that I'd be like, hello.
No.
There's
some paper missing.
And then they sort of congratulate each other on a job well done afterwards. And I'm just like, this is it's just
absolutely
insane.
Mad.
Sorry.
Back at Judith's place. No, these are all good points. Back at Judith's place, they empty out all the shredded paper. Judith reckons that the paper that she saw him shred was shiny, like it was from a magazine. So then they start sorting it out, looking for shiny bits. Just then, Tanaka calls them and says, they're going to arrest Liz Curtis. They check the journey that she booked through Iqbal, and he had driven her to Chris Potts' house. She's the one that stole the gun. So they all dash off to the rowing centre. But guess what? Liz is dead.
As a dodo.
Judith reckons it must have been Elliot, somehow. But he's been doing an auction all day and has an alibi. Danny, Liz's husband, is also away. and has an alibi. What is it with all these alibis? The next day, Judith calls Bex and Susie, and she's been up all night and has put together the shredded paper. It was a page. Yeah, she has. She's managed it.
It's like Ben Miller with the vase.
Yes. Yeah, and the tiny, tiny tube. 3,000 pieces. So the page was from a school alumni magazine that had obituaries of old pupils on it. So two of the names were the names that Giles Bishop used to forge the witness signatures on Ezra's will. So it's proof that he has forged the will. But he can't have killed Iqbal because he has an alibi. He was in hospital. They start looking through old newspapers. Because thankfully, Judith's aunt, who used to live in the house, was a hoarder. So they have newspapers which date back 40 years.
How convenient.
How convenient. They find out who Elliot used to row with when he was at school. And then, this is so preposterous. Judith then starts yelling at Bex and Susie because they're asking questions about her past because they find her study with archaeology bits and, as again, board newspapers.
It's completely pointless. They kept cutting back to this subplot and it took me ages to work out who it was or why it was relevant. No one cares.
No one cares. So there are implications that Judith in her past stole something from an archaeological dig, which, can I just say, sound true to form. Yeah. I mean, she's always thinking so it's not really a massive surprise. But, you know, she's got all this, she gets all wound up about it. And they're like, oh, is this your husband? Why do you still wear your wedding ring? Or whatever. And then she's like, get out. Complete turnaround, like 180 of character. Anyway, so this means that by herself, she'll have to put together the final pieces of the puzzle. And she starts tearing down her murder board because she's so cross. Now she does. She notices an article about Stefan saying he couldn't swim. So you hang in there, just maybe that's relevant, sort of. Anyway, she's working out what twisted, genius plot is at play. And she realises there will be a fourth murder. Her oh. Lex, I'm going to hand over to you at this point because, I mean, can you tell us who did it and why and, you know, everything?
Until they kind of wrapped that up, I hadn't realised why she'd had that whole 180. I was just like, why has she suddenly gone weird? Like, it didn't make any sense. But so Judith has worked out that the killer will come for her, but she doesn't do anything about it.
She doesn't do anything.
Nothing. Nothing at all. She doesn't call the police to get back up. She doesn't warn Bex or Susie. Nothing. What she does is she just waits for the killer to come and get her. Seems nice.
So what if the killer had just killed her and then he would still be on the loose and no one would ever know?
She calls Bex and tells her to definitely not come over later. And it's so weird that Bex calls Susie and Tanaka and thankfully they all agree that they definitely should get over there. And then there's this really weird constructed storm. Like, there's a big storm and a big tree falls down in the road, so oh my god, they can't get to Judith's house. So then Bex goes into church where there's still choir practice going on. I think
it's choir practice all the time, except she was allowed out, so I don't get it.
She then runs into the kitchen, grabs a knife and gets the rope from a church bell and then cuts the rope down and ties it to a 4x4 to drag the tree out of the way. The rain's bashing down. Susie's trying to run to Judith's house. Luna, the dog, is by her side. It's all very dramatic, apparently. The killer's outside the house and cuts the phone line. She's got a mobile, but let's break this. Okay,
that's
cut
really
the landline.
It's slightly dated.
If someone cut our landline cable, I wouldn't know. Genuinely,
we don't have a landline.
Would not know. So then he breaks in, and as Judith is dialing 999, he sort of appears
a bit
to her
late in the day. Why is she calling them now?
He appears to her right and then points the gun at her and she says, "Hello, Danny." It's Liz Curtis's husband, Danny.
What?
Surely not, I hear you cry.
He had an alibi. How does this work?
But how does it work? Well, right, so Danny, Elliot and Giles knew each other from way back and bumped into each other at the regatta. Obviously. They each wanted someone dead. Elliot because he hated Stefan and wanted the Stanley Spencer painting. Danny because Liz wouldn't sell the rowing centre, and Giles who was about to be found out about the will. So they all just decided to kill for each other. Isn't that nice? Yeah. So
buddies.
Danny shot Stefan, and Judith had noted a kayak in the water by Stefan's house when he was shot. But of course, he couldn't swim.
That must have been how Danny got there. God, it's just all coming together.
It's so clever. Elliot shot Iqbal and Giles shot Liz. Judith knew Danny would be coming for her when she heard that both Giles and Elliot were each going away for the night for various reasons. Danny's about to shoot Judith when Susie arrives. The dog jumps through the window and attacks Danny. It's just, insane.
Yeah.
I've watched that action. I say action loosely. I watched that sequence three times. Like, there's a bit where she's like wrestling him for the gun, and then the gun spills, and then there's the dog, and then there's armed police.
Yeah.
And like, I can't remember, I always get this phrasing wrong. Is it prophetic fallacy? Basically the use of weather to kind of imitate like the mood of the thing.
Yep.
So because it's like wind and rain and bashing, it's meant to be like drama, and it's just not. It's really anticlimactic. Obviously, because you said to me, if people are in the credits and so on, or if their name appears later on down the line, you assume that, you know, they're going to come back. So I figured she wasn't going to die. So did you believe it?
I mean, right. I think in the past I have heard about murders where, I don't think it's usually three people, but you know, there's like two people.
Reciprocal.
But I think in that case it's supposed to be like different parts of the country, these people don't even know each other, you know, that sort of thing. This is just like three dudes in Marlow, which is quite not a big place.
It's not a big place at all.
I don't believe any of it. And so also they explained that it wasn't Liz who took Iqbal's taxi after all. It wasn't Liz who took they found out that the journey that Liz had booked was to Chris Botts's house. So they were like, oh yeah, she must have gone there. She must have stolen the gun. She's the killer. But as it turned out, Danny used her phone to make that journey, and he's the one that went to Chris Botts's house and stole the gun. So he seems to be doing quite a lot more than the others, actually. I don't know. I don't believe any of it. And the thing I believe the least is Mrs. Potts and her gang, and the fact that the police were all right with it.
And they're so insincere as characters. Like, it's meant to be sincere, but it just doesn't work. And there was a bit about sort of misdirection at the end where, like, I think Danny calls up and is like gives a false phone call about, like, I've just seen someone try and throw a gun in the river.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then Brendan's like, we should be following that guy. And Tanaka's like, no, I want to make sure that Mrs. Potts is okay.
Yeah.
And then there's like, they try and wrap everything up at the end in this really saccharine, Tanaka goes home to her husband and her daughter. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. That's quite sweet. Although he says, how was your day? And she's like, good. And I'm like, really?
Also, it's daylight. Fine, it's summer, but then that must be, it means the end of the next day. Or is it, because he says, how was your day? But the whole thing with Mrs. Potts and everything and the big storm, that was nighttime. So then she's been away for a whole other day.
Do you know what? I hadn't even noticed. It's really bad continuity if it's meant to be the same day. And then the three of them are punting. Mrs. Potts, they go for a punt
and they have champagne to celebrate.
They have champagne and, like, there's a cake on, like, a stand and sandwiches on a plate. Punt. And, like, I'm not being funny, but that's going in the river. Like, if that was me, all of the food and me and everyone else is ending up in the river. And it's all just like a... and, like,
it's so
Bex, twee. Like, has this sort of suddenly she's back at home and her husband's actually washing up, and it's a kind of idyllic domestic setting, and her daughter's like, I'm going to the pub later with loads of boys, and she's like, yeah, that's fine, I trust you. And I'm like,
you're 12,
and also nothing materially has happened here for them to respect you. Nothing at all. So how is that family dynamic change where the son's no longer lying on his back going, Mum, what's with it? Like, it just, yeah. No. Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting quite angry.
Everything's now come good. They've had their moments now outside their respective worlds, and now everyone could be like, oh.
Oh my God, you're not just a mum, you're not just a wife.
Oh, I'd never realised.
I had no idea that Mum was an actual person.
Anyway, so everything is fine now, and they're just respected, and the police think they're amazing for really getting in the way quite badly.
Really getting in the way quite badly. And I don't believe their friendships.
No.
I don't believe them as people.
No. I think there's a bit where one of them, I think Bex or Susie, I can't remember, she says, oh, Judith, you're incorrigible. And she goes, well, I'd hate to be corrigible.
And they all kind of go,
fuck off, Mrs. Potts. Yeah, it's all this forced laugh. And
but you know what? If the whole thing had been like a 45-minute lunchtime, the lighthearted, whatever, I could kind of make my peace with it. But the fact that it was dragged over 3 hours.
It was 3 hours. And I think what kind of annoyed me was, yeah, it could have been an hour. And also, it's got the whole premise of, oh, these are women who have been overlooked, maybe, you know, older or hidden by motherhood, whatever. But then instead of making them funny, clever, admirable, brave characters, he's made them all ninnies.
What a brilliant word. The fact that when they break into the solicitor's office, one of them's setting off a toaster whilst the other one's climbing through a window, and the other one, and then she hides under a desk. And you just think, like, there is nothing about this. It's smart. It's like, it's not even...
It's very Amdram. And I think, Lex, I think you summed it up perfectly when you messaged me and you said it's got the air of Amdram, where Samantha Bond is the one who's been in the society the longest and therefore has to have the main part. And I think that's it. And also, like, no one... So it's a member of the group who wrote the script. No one wants to, like, upset him, get him to edit it down a bit. And everyone gets a bit. So let's make it... It's like, you know, when you go and see a school play or something that's 3 hours long so that everyone can have a line.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
It's almost like that, to make sure that everyone gets a bit of stuff. Let's just put it all in.
It's like someone's gone, look, you've done a really good audition, but like I've said, Samantha's been here the longest, so she will be getting that big part. Also, she is the treasurer, so my hands are kind of tied.
Absolutely. But we thought you were really good, and you've got this lovely little bit in, like, the auction house, or you've got this lovely little bit, you know, in the police station. So we'll keep all of that in. Just make sure that everyone's got something to do.
And realistically, that bit where you kick the prop over in the auction house, I mean, that is essentially the pivotal moment in the programme. I would say, actually, it's better than the main part. Like, you know, actually, that's the part that everyone wants. Like, you are in a very fortunate position. So if I were you, I'd be absolutely cock-a-hoop. I just don't understand the background story. I don't understand, because when people say you're not nervous, you're not scared, you're not frightened being on your own, and she's like, no, Mrs. Potts says I survived a bad husband, so I'm not, you know, I'll survive this, or something along those. I wasn't frightened of my husband, I'm not going to... And then, so I thought it was a kind of domestic abuse kind of situation. It just turns out he framed her for, like, nicking a pot or something, or a statue from an archaeological dig. I couldn't really give any less of a shit, if I'm honest.
Yeah, like 40 years ago or something. And they're like, oh, Judith, I think you've made retribution for what you did or didn't do in the past. Well, it's just got nothing to do with anything, does it?
No. Apparently he stole a... Either of them stole a statue. It was worth some money. She never saw him again. All right, cool. Great story.
There we go. Great story.
She's in a big house full of plants. An insane number of plants.
So I think probably we didn't believe it.
No.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how much did we believe it? I'm thinking 0.5.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, it was just...
Well, the reviews I'd read were like, oh, it had the end has a twist you'll never see coming.
I saw it coming.
By the end of part one, I was like, Okay, so there's some murders, and all the prime suspects for the murders have alibis, so do we think perhaps they all did it for each other? It wasn't a blinding twist.
So with the whole, like, will they, won't they get there in time to save her thing, where you're like, well, obviously they will, because otherwise it kind of ruins the yeah. series. I was like, is she going to drag the log out the way? Oh, there we go, and they've arrived just yeah, in yeah. time. What a
yeah.
just what a surprise that was.
Time. So dare I ask how we're going to rate this? Just for context, we gave Good Ship Murder 3. We gave Annika 4. They are lowest ranked.
Right. So I found Annika tedious. I liked Good Ship Murder because it was stupid and I didn't have to lose several hours of my life to it.
Also, it was 45 minutes.
Yes. It was 45 minutes. I can deal with nonsense for 45 minutes. And actually, I found myself laughing through Good Ship Murder. I didn't laugh through this. I was just...
I did, but it was more at it rather than with it.
Yes, exactly. I don't know, 2.
Okay. I think for all the reasons we've given, let's just go with 2. And it's such a shame because I do find it odd that Samantha Bond's a really good actor.
She is.
And I think all of them are probably really good actors. You know, I feel like something's just not quite sticking together properly.
It just felt very flat.
And again, it could have been a good plot. It felt forced.
Yeah. It felt like it was trying, I think I said to you, it felt like it was trying to utilise like a time slot or a format for like a gritty crime drama, but we were trying to hang whimsical kind of...
A Rosemary and Thyme-esque thing.
On a much bigger frame, which, so it's very, very thin. Very thin.
Yes. Yes, I think that's accurate.
I probably shouldn't have got as angry about it as I have, and I apologise to all concerned. It's fine. As I say, to coin my mother's word, it's fine.
Fine.
It's fine.
Fine. It's fine. Well, a 2 is probably not actually that fine, is it? It wasn't fine. It was a bit rubbish.
It was a bit shit, but...
Next time, we're going to find something shorter. Yeah? Let's find something shorter for our next one, because we've done a couple of two-parters now, haven't we? What was the last thing we watched?
Waking the Dead.
Yeah, so that was a two-parter. So let's find something that is shorter next time.
Just
for all our sakes.
Yeah, that would be great.
Then if we don't enjoy it, we don't have to sit through several hours.
It was when you said to me it was long, and I was like, it's not that long. And then I realised that was just the first part.
Yeah, and it's long. Like, you feel it inside your soul that you've been there for a long time.
I kept pausing it going, how much... Oh, I've still got another fucking 45 minutes left.
Yeah.
Surely
that's
not.
That's just not what you want. That's not what you want from something that you're supposed to be enjoying. I love crime drama. Don't do this to me. All right, onwards. Find something brighter, better, with Pam Ferris in it. Or another one with Trevor Eve. I don't know.
Many with Trevor Eve.
Sue Johnston. Let's go find something with Sue Johnston
in
it. Yes.
Send in your recommendations for Sue Johnston-based programmes.
Yes, please.